from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, Republicans are blasting the Obama administration's prisoner swap that saw an American prisoner of war on Saturday exchanged for the release of five high-ranking Taliban prisoners. In our opening hour, we talk with experts about the deal, and we analyze the president's foreign policy speech delivered at West Point last week. The United States remains indispensable as a global leader, the president said, but he urged restraint before embarking on further military interventions. The speech was in part a response to critics who claim the president has reacted weakly to crises in Ukraine, Syria, and elsewhere. We'll talk about it next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Last week at West Point's commencement, President Barack Obama delivered a speech outlining a shift in U.S. foreign policy. He urged ongoing restraint in the use of the U.S. military while emphasizing America's ongoing global leadership role, calling America an indispensable nation and making the case for U.S. exceptionalism. The president's speech came in the wake of criticism from both major parties of a weakening of American leadership in the world and polls showing at least half of Americans disapproving of the president's leadership in foreign policy. We discuss the president's speech in this hour, as well as the administration's controversial prisoner swap that freed an American POW on Saturday in exchange for the release of five high-ranking Taliban prisoners. Joining us from New York City is Richard Haass. He's president of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a nonpartisan organization that focuses on foreign policy issues. He's also the author, most recently, of Foreign Policy Begins at Home, The Case for Putting America's House in Order. And glad to have you back on Forum, Richard Haass.
Good to be with you, Michael.
And we also want to welcome Barry Pavel, who is Vice President and Director of the, Pavel, Vice President and Director of the Brent Snowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council, joining us this morning from the nation's capital. Welcome, Barry Pavel.
Thanks very much.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Janine Davidson, who is also with us from Washington, D.C. She's a Senior Fellow for Defense Policy with the Council on Foreign Relations and was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for plans in the Obama administration from 2009 to 2012. Janine Davidson, let me go to you first. This is being seen as a deal, particularly by the Republicans, which is a bad deal, I suppose it's best to say. Sending five of their bad guys back to the Taliban, which still supports al-Qaeda, but also placing a good deal of emphasis on the fact that this puts a bounty on the heads of American soldiers, breaks a bad precedent, and it's also being ballyhooed by critics that the released sergeant supposedly was a deserter, Bo Bergdahl. Now, I don't know if that's been corroborated or not, but in other words, what we're hearing from critics of President Obama is all around this a bad deal.
Well, I think that it's a deal that's not without risk. I mean, definitely we've said before that the Guantanamo Bay issue has been trouble from the beginning. I mean, is this a crime of terrorism? Is this an actual war? We have been at war with the Taliban, and we're now at war with al-Qaeda. And so this is the kind of messy things that happens during wars. Now, these are five bad guys, and I think we should all reserve a little bit of judgment until we find out exactly what the deal was, because it is a risky thing to let these bad guys go back to the fight. They're older now. They're in their mid to late 40s. Some of them are worse than others. And the last time we let one of these guys go, he did go back to take on a key role in the Taliban in the actual fight. So the devil is in the details about what was the deal cut with Qatar. How are the Qataris going to ensure that these guys don't get actively back into the fight? And I don't think we have those details yet.
Well, the devil may be in the details, Barry Pavel, but it's also being seen as a bad precedent. And yet some are saying, well, this may open up channels of communication with the Taliban. How do you see it?
With Janine, I think it's a little too early to tell. But look, when you bring back one of our military from a long time in captivity, that's a win no matter what else happens. And so we'll see what else the details are. But I think this is something we should be happy about.
Agree, Richard Haass?
Well, it's hard to be happy about it. The best reason to have done it is in some ways modeled on the Israeli policy, where you get your people back and you don't do it so much for the individual who's in question, but you do it for the rest of the troops, and it sends a message that you will leave nobody behind. So it's an important part of morale building and essentially loyalty return for those who risk their lives. You are willing to do everything in return to get them back, hopefully alive, if need be, though, even if they are, if they're dead. But that said, for all the reasons you mentioned, Michael, the fact that you've got five people with terrible records, this does no favor to the new Afghan government that will soon be in place. It increases incentives if need be, to capture Americans. There are certain questions about Mr. Bergdahl himself, so this is controversial. The only thing that really surprised me besides the deal itself was the degree to which the White House made it a very public event with the President, with the Secretary of Defense, with the Secretary of State. And given all this controversy, I found it somewhat difficult to discern the logic for making this such a public development.
What about, Richard, your take on the logic of the President talking about pulling out to 10,000 troops and actually the head of the CIA being outed, which has caused a great deal of consternation, and the fact that when we look at Afghanistan now, from any kind of objective perspective, if that's possible, al-Qaeda is pretty much in control of Fallujah.
Well, that's getting Iraq and Afghanistan connected. I mean, in terms of Iraq, just very briefly, look, it shows the danger of having no residual force. And I'm not saying had we kept a residual force in Iraq, everything would have gone swimmingly. But the fact that the United States did not negotiate as hard as it might have to keep a residual force in Iraq clearly has made a difficult situation that much more difficult. Now, what is it?
Well, forgive me, it's less difficult with Karzai out, though, because he wasn't
Just to come back to Afghanistan, but just to finish Iraq, you now have 1,000 people a month being killed there. In terms of Afghanistan, I was not happy with the announced policy on Afghanistan. Yes, we're going down to a residual force of 9,800 by the end of this year, but the president also said we're going down to zero in 2 years, no matter what. And that seems to me exactly wrong. There's a difference between an exit timetable and an exit strategy, and I believe we would have been far better served by having a conditions-based policy where we would arguably be open to keeping forces there if the costs and benefits made sense, as opposed to a calendar-based policy. So I simply disagree with the direction we're going in Afghanistan.
Is it sort of injudicious in some ways, Barry Pavel, to give away the whole hand like that and to say we'll be out by 2016? As the president did?
I fully agree with Richard. This is a situation where the United States has invested an untold amount of blood and treasure, the longest war in our history. And to set some arbitrary deadline that just happens to coincide with the month before the next president is inaugurated, I think, is obviously not strategic. I think, look, we've left troops in a number of countries where we had longer-term conflicts, Japan, Korea, Germany, United Kingdom, Bosnia, some troops. I mean, so if we thought it was important enough to leave troops, to send so many troops, to surge, et cetera, then I think a longer-term relationship with Afghanistan as a partner of some sort would likely merit a certain number of troops to conduct some important missions for the mutual benefit of both countries.
Well, let me go back to you, Janine Davidson, because a lot of this seems to have to do, or could be tied in at least, to the speech that was delivered the day after the president spoke about the withdrawal of troops, the speech he delivered at West Point, which essentially was a kind of doctrine that said boots off the ground. I mean, the administration is talking about $5 billion and more for anti-terrorism and a lot more drones, fewer drones, excuse me, and more transparency about drones. But holding up on the military and building trust with nations, does that really translate into the new government in Afghanistan?
Yeah, well, let me just make a couple points about Afghanistan. I think there's both good and a little things, a few things to be worried about here. On the upside, he needed to make some sort of a comment about what the intent was. It's not just about what Afghanistan is thinking and what the Afghans need to know. It's also, that's very important, but it's also about our allies. I mean, they need to decide and they need to plan what they need to be leaving in the region as well. So the good news is that the president didn't did not heed the call of some other critics that wanted him to go even faster and smaller, down to something like 2,000 troops by this year. That would have been, I think, a disaster, and I think he recognized that, and he stayed at what the military wanted, which is closer to 10,000. And that lets our allies also be able to plan so that you can actually have a better slope. But I do share some of the concerns of Richard and Barry that this can be a very, very quick slope, and that can be very risky. It's true that we've had troops in the Balkans for much longer than that. The slope of redeployment was a lot slower, and that is how these sorts of interventions end. It takes a while to hand off all these responsibilities to the host nation country. So while I am open to being optimistic that this aggressive withdrawal schedule will work, I do hope that after a year or so, that there is at least a vector check, if you will, or a reassessment of what's happening on the ground before they continue on to the announced timeline.
Janine Davidson, again, a senior fellow for defense policy with the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, and Richard Haass is president of the Council on Foreign Relations and also author most recently of Foreign Policy Begins at Home, the case for putting America's house in order. Richard, at this point, what can Obama look to optimistically in terms of possible successes? I mean, certainly in some respects, Iran has been put forward in that way as far as foreign policy. Seems to be getting some traction with Putin backing down by at least some people's lights, even though he took he took Crimea. I mean, where can he – there's even talk about opening things up again with Cuba. Where do you see things actually optimistically that he can tout as successes? And by the way, I want to frame that question particularly in light of the fact that he's a lame duck president, and often they move toward foreign policy type of issues and don't necessarily have success because Congress isn't all that cooperative with them that makes them move that way in the first place.
Well, yeah, that's for sure. And we don't know exactly what will be the lineup in the Congress after the November elections, but it's almost certain to be worse for Democrats than it is now. So you'll have an even more divided government, and people will be looking at very much at 2016. The one thing the president still has is the tradition and the Constitution, which is as bad as things can get. He still has more latitude when it comes to foreign policy than he will have to domestic policy. That said, I would say there's a couple of things. One is the possibility of the negotiations with Iran. Though I hasten to add, Michael, if that's your potential success, you're in trouble, just given how difficult those negotiations have been and promise to continue to be. And a more likely outcome is not where we quote-unquote succeed, but simply there are some signs of progress, some areas where we can't agree, and the question is whether you can quote-unquote kick that down the road. Two other areas I'd mention. One is you've got a new government in India, that one with unprecedented domestic support. And I would think there's an opportunity to develop a more expanded economic relationship and a more strategic relationship across the board with that government. And then lastly, this area of trade. The United States has talked a lot about the pivot. An essential component of the so-called pivot towards Asia is a trans-Pacific trade deal. We've also been negotiating a trans-Atlantic trade deal with our European allies. And again, if the president wants to, he could go to Congress and make this his legislative priority to get the authority to negotiate both of these agreements. And I think if he were to do so, it would make for excellent strategy, and it would also be a real boost to America's economic growth. And he could do that. He's just got to decide that it's worth the political capital.
Well, I read your piece in the World Post, and you were somewhat critical both of what he's doing and what he's not doing, but you laid out a lot of ideas about what he might do. And one of them had to do with essentially strengthening energy by getting a kind of Atlantic energy initiative on the move. I mean, particularly with respect to all the dependency on Russia throughout Europe.
Exactly right. It's obviously one of the things that limits European willingness to take a robust line towards Mr. Putin. And we see with Ukraine, the fact that Russia can jack up energy prices at any moment leaves Ukraine much more vulnerable politically and economically to Russia. So a long-term, it's not an immediate thing, but a long-term program or project of increasing European energy output through everything from nuclear to fracking to also the United States being able to export gas and oil in significant quantities to Europe. All that could help. And then another thing we could do related to that.
You even mentioned the Keystone Pipeline, didn't you?
Sure. I mean, if you're going to ask the Germans to once again turn on nuclear plants, and if you're going to ask the French to do the controversial step of fracking so they produce natural gas, it seems to me it's a little bit easier for a president to say, I'm asking you to take tough steps politically. And by the way, I've just taken one myself, which is the Keystone Pipeline, which is only being held up, as best I can see, for political reasons. And if he refuses to do that, I believe it makes it more difficult for him to ask them to take a difficult step.
Richard, all due respect, I can hear the environmentalists going through kind of atavistic screams when you say it's only politics holding it up.
Well, I mean, they're wrong on the environment. Quite honestly, on the environment, it's not an argument. This oil is going to be produced by Canada one way or another. So to argue that this is an environmental argument simply doesn't bear serious scrutiny. One way or another, this oil is going to be produced, transported, and put on the world market. And the only question is whether it heads into the United States or not. So we shouldn't kid ourselves that this is a big environmental question. It simply isn't. It's largely a political question. And by the way, by not going ahead, it not only hurts us with Europe, but it hurts us significantly with Canada, which is in some ways our most important energy and economic relationship.
And Barry Pavel, since we mentioned the relationship particularly with Europe and oil and fracking and all of that, interested in getting your take at this point on the president's upcoming trip, which actually begins today, to Europe, particularly in light of the fact that, and I read the piece you did about this being a Westphalian plus world, which I might have you actually ask you to explain a little bit, but here the president's going to deal with all these nation states in Europe, which are seemingly pivoting over to the right in many cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think his trip is meant to buttress the transatlantic relationship in a time of really unprecedented challenge since no time like the Cold War. I do think he's handled the Russian actions reasonably well. I think if he overplayed, if he threw too many military forces to reinforce NATO, if he spoke too stridently, if he did sectoral sanctions, I think that plays into Putin's narrative, that plays into his strengthening his base, and he could have told his main supporters, see, they do want a new Cold War, they are threatening us, this is an us versus them thing. And I think so instead, I think he focused a lot of the measures that the United States and Europe took together on the specific individuals, the specific people that are part of Putin's inner circle. I think that's the way to do it. We don't want to get the entire Russian nation aligned against us more than they already are. So I think this trip is a continuation of the discussions, the public statements, the other actions that the administration has taken since the beginning of the real crisis with Crimea in the beginning of the year and continuing now. I did think his speech helped a bit with the concept of we are in a new world where it's not the same world as it was even 10 or 15 years ago, because the growth of the power of people is much bigger than it was before, and it's going to continue exponentially. And so I think if he can continue to sort of flesh out his approach of how we have to deal with individuals and groups, how we have to start to reframe how the United States looks at the world. It's no longer all about stability, which was really our primary goal since the end of World War II. And the president really went into this in some unremarked aspects of his speech. I thought it was a good beginning. A lot more needs to be said, and a lot more needs to be done. The part I was least sort of satisfied with from his discussion was there was a lot of concepts in his West Point speech, not a lot of what he's going to do about it. I mean, we know he's going to do the $5 billion fund on counterterrorism, a little more support to Syrian moderate rebels if they exist, but not a lot more on changing institutions, which he talked about the need to do, on dealing with China, a very assertive and rising China, on continuing to deal with Russia and its next moves. I sort of wanted more action and a little less concept.
Well, in fact, Janine Davidson, let me go to you on China, because there's growing assertiveness on China, all this territorial dispute in the South China Sea, and China accusing the United States and Japan of using, that is China's military talking about the United States and Japan using rather harsh rhetoric and possibly being aggressive from their perspective. Is the president really wanting on this, and how does this tie in with the pivot?
Well, first of all, on the West Point speech, not mentioning China, I think that, first of all, it was very important for the president to lay down his vision. He needed to refute claims of American decline, retrenchment. He needed to state clearly that that America still is engaged in the world and that it wants to lead. I think in the next couple weeks, you're going to start seeing, hopefully, you know, what are the pieces of that vision? So this was a vision speech intentionally. It wasn't like a laundry list of what we're going to do in each little spot around the world. So that said, on the rebalance to Asia, it's been fairly misunderstood a lot, but it's never been designed as some sort of a containment strategy against China. It's really about reaffirming to our allies and our partners in the region that we are an Asian power, that we are going to continue to support multilateral solutions to the complex problems in the region, everything from climate change to piracy and the natural disasters. And you see a lot of the military pieces of the rebalance is focused on engaging with other militaries to help them build up their abilities and their capabilities to handle these problems. And that has a knock-on effect of enhancing interoperability and cooperation among these countries. One of the countries that is always invited to the table in these things is China. And so my sense is that while there has definitely a lot to worry about in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, and with China's increasing assertiveness in the region, I think that what I worry about most is an unintended escalation of a conflict in the region. And the best way to handle, the best way to help prevent something from spinning out of control is to continue to engage with the countries in the region, to continue to have military exercises, and to push for rules of engagement and lines of communication so that when something does heat up, you can tamp it down and dial it down with military-to-military relationships.
Forgive me, Jeanine. So I want to actually, since you mentioned that there wasn't anything specific in, about China, and Barry Pavel the same, we've only got about a minute left with Richard Hasson. I just wanted to say that the president did, Richard, mention Syria specifically, and maybe a little bit too late, trying to do something with the rebels who may indeed be jihadists, many of them?
Well, many of them now are, and what quote-unquote non-jihadists there might have been are few now, but he did open up the possibility of greater help for the non-jihadist opposition, and in principle that's welcome. He has to now come up with a specific program and get Congress on board. It's unfortunate this didn't happen 3 years ago or 2 years ago or a year ago, but in any case, it was one part of the speech that I thought was a step in the right direction.
Richard Hass, we have to say goodbye to you. Appreciate very much you being with us. And again,
thanks, Michael.
Richard Hass is president of the Council on Foreign Relations, author of Foreign Policy Begins at Home. You can join us in this conversation. We do welcome your phone calls. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. Your responses to the prisoner swap, your responses to the president's speech at West Point, talking generally about foreign policy. Let's get your thoughts and feelings. 866-733-6786. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking really about foreign policy this hour, and a whole range of subjects have been part of the mix, talking about, well, ongoing crisis with Russia and Ukraine, about the pivot toward China, about most recently the change, at least in the president's most recent speech at West Point, which seems to be a change towards Syria, but also talking really about the nature of what the president's foreign policy is, what he hopes to accomplish, especially as he prepares to be 4 days in Europe, and also about the swap that occurred this past weekend, which has caused a great deal of controversy. Five al-Qaeda leaders taken from Guantanamo and sent back essentially in exchange for an American soldier. And you may want to weigh in here. And in fact, we would like to hear from you if you have some thoughts or if you have some questions or comments. Our toll-free number, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite, is available. It's 866-733-6786. If you have something you'd like to add to the conversation, please feel free to join us. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, and you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Our guests are Janine Davidson, Senior Fellow for Defense Policy, who's with us from the nation's capital. She's at the Council on Foreign Relations and is former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Plans in the Obama administration from 2009 to 2012. Also with us by phone from Washington, D.C. is Barry Pavel, Vice President and Director of the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council. And again, you are welcome to join the program. Reading some email comments here. Robert writes, my question is whether your guests agree with Peter Beinart's May 21st comments in the Atlantic, and he's quoting Peter Beinart, foreign policy strategy requires harmonizing means and ends, yet during the first two decades of the post-Cold War era, American foreign policy commentators stopped trying to define the limit to America's overseas ends. The results of this shift are especially troublesome today as America struggles with reduced means. After years of post-9/11 increases, America's defense budget is decreasing, end of quote. And, well, other questions about the cost benefits of retaining forces in Afghanistan. Let me get a take from you on this, Janine Davidson. I mean, particularly in terms of where the resources are and where they're going to be, since the president has pledged $5 billion for counterterrorism.
Well, look, I think that there is no doubt that we are having a declining defense budget. But I think people need to put this in perspective. We're still at this moment up on Capitol Hill arguing over a 490-some billion-dollar defense budget. That is larger than the defense budget in real dollars was in 2001. And so it's what people look at a lot of times is that we're coming off of a huge spending spree over the last 10 years in response to 9/11, the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. It makes perfect sense that as we come out of those wars, we will downsize and we will not spend as much money on our military. That said, $500 billion plus another $70 billion to fight the war in Afghanistan is a heck of a lot of money. It's more than the rest of the world spends on their defense combined.
Want to weigh in here, Barry Pavel?
Yeah, I agree with Janine. We've grew the budget quite a bit since 2001, and it's time to bring it back down, and even the levels we're talking about are not even close to the pre-2001 levels, although the automaticity of some of the sequestration cuts does present some significant specific problems. That said, I think, you know, if the military is no longer the tool, the primary tool for use overseas, which I agree with the president, it's time, we're in a different era. We have different tools at our disposal as a nation to deal with the challenges and seize the opportunities. I think even with a dysfunctional Congress, it's time to start growing some of the other tools. And I know it's difficult and it's an uphill battle, but this is what presidents get elected for, to lead, to launch campaigns, to mobilize people. So let's get diplomacy better funded. Let's get economic instruments more integrated. Let's do better on cyber. Let's look to leverage the technologies that the United States leads the world on to do more in the world. Let's just start moving towards rebalancing our tools and not just saying, I think rightfully the president's been talking about the need for restraint, because the use of the military should not always be the primary instrument. Now let me argue a little bit against myself, that there is a time to use the military instrument in limited and focused ways, and that I think with all of this withdrawal and the perception of withdrawal, I think that's very important that we're seeing and hearing from our colleagues in the Middle East and in Asia. I think it's important to make sure you combat that perception in a very meaningful and sustained fashion. And I think that's what I would have liked to have seen more, not just from the speech, but from the follow-up. How are we going to combat this perception that the United States is withdrawing, even if the perception is incorrect? When President Nixon and Kissinger were withdrawing the United States from the Vietnam War, they took other measures to make sure it was very clear that the United States is not leaving the region. We need to do the same thing.
No, the president actually used the I word. I mean, he said we're not being isolationist. He was talking mainly about diplomacy and kind of the soft side of strength. But you've written about the necessity for really building a new U.S. National security strategy. How do you propose the president ought to proceed on that line?
Well, we're going to have to do a lot of different things at once. Nation states aren't going away. We're seeing China very, very aggressive in Asia right now, and we're seeing Russia rather aggressive in its own region as well. So we have to deal with those with the instruments that are appropriate. And in this case, I think I'd be a little stronger with China, although there was a pretty strong speech from the Secretary of Defense this weekend in Asia that the Chinese speaker came back with, also very hard. I think we need to start a little more clearly sort of reining the Chinese military in from taking these very aggressive actions, such as putting a $1 billion oil rig in international waters that are disputed with Vietnam, and then ringing it with military ships and saying no ships can come between these ships and the oil rig. This is not an actor that's satisfied with the status quo, and if you let that continue, then we will be in for much greater risks, much greater tensions down later this year or next year or the year after, et cetera. Now, I think on the new aspects of the environment that I think are going to get much more significant, that's the power of individuals to do a lot of good, but also to do a lot of ill. I think we need to sort of start moving towards a strategy that leverages people.
I don't know if I'm still on, but we just had some kind of electric shock here that lost our guests and lost those of you who are waiting on the phone lines. I'm not even sure I'm being heard here because I'm not certain what happened. And this is what we call, let's go to the ISDN line and get the guests back on here. And I'm not sure how we'll we do have Janine. Janine, are you there?
I am.
Yeah, we just
I can hear you loud.
We just had a serious kind of outage, so I'm glad to hear your voice. We can pick up on that point that Barry was making here about a new national security strategy. I mean, do you see things in terms of or envision things along those lines, what to do?
Yeah, I mean, I do agree with a lot of what Barry's saying. I think people are never, ever going to be satisfied with whatever it is that we call strategy. We look back on the Cold War as though things were so clear at the time and we had a clear strategy against one, you know, big actor, the Soviet Union. But I think it was a lot cloudy then at the time, and it always is. And so what I think that the president has laid out a vision that says, look, you know, the global architecture, the global institutions, the United Nations, the IMF, the World Bank, and all the array of international legal agreements that we have, those are actually set up by the United States to promote global order, and they actually work for the world, but they actually work for the United States. And so it is actually in our interest to continue to promote those institutions and to sustain that sort of global order. What you see, and this is where I agree with what Barry was saying, what you see with China, and you also see it with Russia and Vladimir Putin, are actors that are not satisfied with that global architecture, that are challenging it in very tactical ways that we find difficult to counter. And I agree we're definitely going to have to start checking those sorts of challenges to the order. And one of the other ways to do that, or one of the best ways to do that, is to continue to reaffirm our support for those institutions and our support for multilateral cooperation and engagement, to continue to make it clear that that sort of behavior is unacceptable and destabilizing and not in anybody's best interest.
Well, the president emphasized multilateral cooperation in that West Point speech, didn't he?
Yes, that's right. And I think it's been a keystone of his approach since he took office. One thing that America has that not everybody has in the world is convening authority. If America shows up to a problem and says they're going to work on it, other people show up too. And so one of the things that we can do is through leadership, or one of the ways you can sort of define American leadership going forward in the 21st century, we could catalyze multilateral activity on an array of global problems that no one nation state, not even the United States, can do on their own. Things like climate change, problems in the Arctic, Even things like piracy. You know, we lead a multinational effort off the Horn of Africa to deal with piracy, which had become a multi-billion dollar disruption in the global economy and has been really tamped down over the last couple of years. And it's true that if the United States weren't there, weren't setting up the architecture that other people can plug into, it wouldn't be happening. That's just an example of the way in which U.S. leadership can catalyze multilateral activity.
I want to move into our phone calls. And again, you can join us toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @kqedforum. Here's Tom. Tom, you're up on with us on Forum. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm a liberal supporter of the president, but I've been very disappointed with what seems to be his natural tendency, both at home and abroad, toward accommodating his enemies. He accommodates the Republicans who wish him ill, and he accommodates Vladimir Putin, who is now the leader of the far right in Europe, who certainly is doing everything he can to destroy liberal values in that part of the world and to undo all the progress we've made in 25 years.
I'm not sure. Tom, excuse me. When you say he's accommodating Putin, you know, he essentially set up some pretty serious, by some people's lights, sanctions against Russia. Was that?
Those are not serious, sir. I know that area very well, and those are not serious at all. Putin's cash flow in a week is enough to put him in the ranks of the Forbes, you know, richest individuals in the world. That won't hurt them at all.
Barry Pavel.
Yes.
Glad we got you back, by the way. I'm sorry. what happened to our electricity there? But go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think the specifics of the sanctions we can argue about, but I think if we do broad-based sectoral sanctions against Russia and start shutting various Russian industries down and affecting the average Russian person, I don't think that's in our interest as a country. I think we want to focus like a laser beam on destroying the cohesion between Putin and his cronies and the other centers of power who were advising him. We want to focus on them, not the entire Russian nation. This isn't the Russian nation going to war, being aggressive. This is an illegitimate leader who's using his power base in very specific ways, and I think we need to focus on destroying that power base.
One of the big questions as the president moves through Europe on this four-day trip is whether or not he'll actually see Putin. They're having separate dinners with the president of France, and whether or not they'll actually be face-to-face is one of the questions that got to follow with great interest. Let me go to more of your calls, and let me go to Frank next. Frank, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. I wanted to pick up on the comment about rebalancing and ask us, both panel members, some specific comments that they would, if you ran the zoo in China, with respect to both Japan and Vietnam and the various South China Sea confrontations that are going on right now, what mix of pressures, whether alliance-based or economic, would you recommend to the president that he implement compared to what he's doing now?
Janine Davidson.
Well, I do think it's a really tricky question. I think that we have more levers than people think, or that we think we have sometimes. I mean, there are economic levers, but they do come at a cost. And I'm sure Barry has some thoughts on that as well. But
it is a tricky question, like you said.
Yeah, yeah. But in terms of militarily, though, like I said before, I think that we need to focus on ensuring that these confrontations don't spin out of control. And I think we need to focus on having some consequences for when China goes over these lines.
Barry Pavel.
Yeah, I mean, this is a dicey situation, in particular where China has put a $1 billion oil rig exactly in disputed territory with Vietnam, and then they rang the rig with military ships, and in the first period of time said there's a mile keep-out zone, the second period of time 2 mile, third, like 5 miles. I'm using the exact quantities illustratively, but they've been expanding this ring around this oil rig, and they've been ramming Vietnamese ships, merchant ships and others. One of the sailors was injured. They've been firing water cannons at these ships. This is very aggressive action. Now, when China did something analogous late last year when they declared an air defense identification zone. I was extremely impressed with the United States' response. We very quickly said that we will not respect this zone, and we very quickly flew a B-52 bomber right through the zone. I thought that was very effective, and I think we should be looking to do something very similar, if it's possible to do so here. That would be number one. Number two, China is so overplaying its hand so aggressively that it's getting all of these Southeast Asian nations calling for them to stop and calling for U.S. Diplomatic help, et cetera. We now even have Indonesia mobilized because China's claims are starting to impinge on their territory. Indonesia's redeployed its own military assets toward its north to better deal with the threat that they see coming from China. When you get a country like Indonesia, which is the big country on the block down in Southeast Asia, against you, in addition to Vietnam, in addition to Taiwan, the Philippines, and others, you know, and Japan, obviously, you know where the source of the problem lies, and I think it's time for the United States to work with all of these countries diplomatically to make it very clear that China can't deal with them one by one, which is the way they like to deal with them.
Yeah, we keep arguing that we can work with China somehow to bring North Korea to, shall we say, better ground or more diplomatic ground that moves them away from this need to set off nuclear weapons every now and then. I don't know how that's going to work in this calculus, but it seems like China's the only card that the United States has to play with North Korea. I wanted to read an email from Gary who says, forget the significance of the prisoners traded for the American. Just do the math. Why trade five people to get one back? Now, that's, of course, a good question that many people in Israel have been asking, even on a greater scale. Let me get another caller in here, and that's you, Buck. Hi, you're on. Buck,
hey, this conversation is kind of disappointing. You make two assumptions with which I disagree entirely. Number one, you assume that America power should dominate the world on behalf of international corporations, number one. And number two, should we cut back to 2001 levels of the Defense Department budget? The question is, should we cut it by 50% or 75%? Michael Antonio Graham should be very disappointed with this show.
Well, I thank you for the call. We'll let it stand. Not sure that he's hearing what's being discussed exactly, but let me get another caller on here. And Khaled, that's you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. So I would like to focus my comments on Syria today. Basically, it's been a failing, clearly it's a failing policy. I would like to point out that not only the jihadists are the problem there, but also Hezbollah, another terrorist group, and the Iranians are there. They're practically ruling the whole country. Why should we care? They have more foreign fighters than Iraq and Afghanistan at any point. And we're basically paying the Syrians there to die with their belly full and not doing anything. You might argue that the chemical weapons are out, but they're having another sort of chemical weapons, the chlorine. They're also having those explosive barrels. They're killing people. You know, in the past month, there was over 3,000 civilian deaths. The least we can do is enforce a no-fly zone if we're not able to give them the anti-aircraft missiles, if we're worried about that. I don't have any reason to believe that President Obama's policy has changed overnight. You still have the same set of advisors. He still, I don't know what's the pivotal point that made him want to change his policy overnight.
Well, I think you're raising a very important question with respect to Syria. I mean, it's a change in policy that, from some people's perspective, has maybe come too late, particularly after the president talked about the red line, but they did get rid of the chemical weaponry. Also, what we're hearing a lot now, Janine Davidson, vis-a-vis Syria, is the fact that and with good reason. There are people from Europe who've gone to fight as jihadists in Syria and are getting training there. There are Americans even. There was an American who blew himself up, American citizen, who was fighting as a jihadist in Syria. There was another trained Syrian who killed some people over in Belgium in a Jewish museum. This is of concern because we're talking about quite possibly hundreds of Europeans and Americans who have gone over there and now coming back as citizens presents serious threat here or in Europe.
Absolutely. You know, Syria is a huge, huge tragedy on a human scale. The casualties that have been happening there, the civilian deaths, the millions of displaced people, it is an absolute tragedy. in addition, it is a huge regional and, as you described, global risk. And for your listeners who don't think that America should be involved and engaged abroad, this is an example of where we absolutely should be. I was happy to hear the president say that he's going to be engaging more and training and assisting the moderate opposition. But look, let's be serious.
How do you determine who that moderate opposition is when you've got like about 40% of them apparently not moderate at all? By any standard.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Both sides in this civil war are hard to support. You're obviously not going to support Assad, and then you look at the opposition forces, and it's a mix of terrorists, and you've got the al-Nusra Front who are bad. You've got aligned with al-Qaeda, and then you have the folks from the ISIS that have spilled out from Iraq who are so bad that the al-Qaeda kicked them out of their club. So who do you help here? Now, there is a sliver of people that we are identifying that we're trying to help. Many of us feel that maybe we could have – had we done that earlier, we might have inoculated the opposition against some of these worse actors. But, you know, it's a counterfactual and you're never going to know. So at this point, we can do what we can do and only hope that it's going to have an effect.
Well, in some seasoned veterans of Middle East politics and those who are, I suppose we could call pundits, you hear, Barry Pavel, that we might as well accept the fact that the Alawite regime under Assad is going to endure, and maybe you can do something in the long run, but in the short run, very unlikely.
I don't agree with that at all. I've been very consistent on my position for 3 years now. I think this is the greatest festering danger to the United States that I see right now out there, because every day that goes by, we're breeding more extremists who will come back and attack Europe or the United States. We should have been, a long time ago, we should have been more involved. It's not too late because there are still things going on there. I do think we need to use air power for very limited and focused purposes. We've done it in the past in history. There's no reason we couldn't do it again. It's not a choice between boots on the ground and doing other things. There's lots of options in between.
Barry, what do you think has held up a no-fly zone? I mean, it's been advocated even to some extent by Secretary Kerry seemed to think it was a good idea, but it was done in Libya and it's not been done in Syria.
I just think that, I mean, from the reports of the press, so I have no inside knowledge on this particular issue, I think this White House has not wanted to do it. I think they are being overly cautious, and I think they are underestimating greatly in this case the risks of inaction. I understand their concern about the risks of action, but I think in this case, the risks of inaction are growing by the day.
Let me bring another caller on. That's you, William. Welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. earlier on, you said correctly, I'm pretty sure, that over 50% of the people object to President Obama's foreign policy. The issue is presented as there being two sides at the present time. It's being presented that way. I don't mean on the show, but in general. Is he being aggressive enough, or are his policies correct? What's not in that equation is what many people feel is that that his policies are too aggressive in terms of the military budget, etc. I won't get into that. We're all aware of it. So when someone says that 50% object to his policies, since the argument is between are they aggressive enough or are they okay, the assumption is that what people hear is that 50% feel they're not aggressive enough. But indeed, there may very well be 50% who are against his policies, but one must take into account the people like me who feel that his policies are too aggressive. Particularly, I might add, when I drive on MacArthur Boulevard each week and see in Oakland and see long lines of people waiting for food handouts because their incomes in the United States are too low.
I think you make an excellent point. When I spoke about this earlier, I said that according to polls, at least half of Americans disapprove of the foreign policy approach that President Obama presently has, and that can mean many people who stand with you. So I'm glad you brought it up, and I thank you for that. At this point, by the way, I had mentioned this before, Barry Pavel, and I wanted to not leave it in the lurch here. You talk about this. We've been talking about foreign policy from the standpoint of West Point and what may be an Obama doctrine taking shape, at least to some degree. When you talk about the Treaty of Westphalia back in the 17th century and how we've reached a different position from what was the Westphalian world that we lived in, I'd like you to maybe sketch that out a little bit more for listeners. I didn't want to leave it hanging.
Sure. I mean, since the end of World War II, roughly, I won't go all the way back to 1648 here, but since the end of World War II, the United States, as the most significant power astride the world, has been focused on preserving stability in regions that are key to our economy or our security. And we preserve that security, largely have done so, through the routine day-to-day use of our military to engage overseas with other militaries. We have the largest and most effective network of alliances and partnerships that any nation has ever had in the world, and countries want to be our ally because they know that they share interests with us. I think we should continue to say that stability is important and to pursue it to a degree. But I think the world's already changed over the last 15 or 20 years, where there's a lot of change going on now. Change that is unstable, at least in the near term, where there are people who, for the first time in human history, can see anywhere else what's going on with other people, and they often see things they want. They want jobs. They want dignity. They want human rights. They want freedom of expression. They want all the things that they see other people have, and this is a new dimension of history, of world events.
Let us leave it there because we are out of time, but I want to thank you, Barry Pavel, again, Vice President and Director of the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council, and thank Janine Davidson, who is Senior Fellow for Defense Policy with the Council on Foreign Relations, and thanks also to Richard Haass, the President of the CFR. And thanks to you, our listeners, because we wouldn't be here without you. We have another hour of forum coming up. We're going to meet local novelist Andrew Monacos, and we're also going to talk about Beach Blanket Babylon. So stay where you are. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.